We are going to be back in Genesis 9 today, and turn there if you would. Last week we studied the Noahic covenant, this promise that God made to Noah and his wife and their sons and daughters-in-law and to all the animals and even to all future generations of people on the earth. Quite a wide promise that there would never be a repeat judgment on the earth whereby God would destroy all life through a flood. Unlike his later promise to Israel, which was a conditional promise about staying in the land. If you obey me, then you'll be able to continue living here. That was a conditional promise. This is an unconditional covenant. No matter what happens, God is never going to destroy the whole earth through a flood again. Nothing could cause him to change his mind. Nothing could cause him to go back on his word. The promise is fixed in the heavens, along with that rainbow that is a sign for us. And if you think about Noah and his family, you know, they're fresh off of the ark. They had spent a year there. Talk about cabin fever, right? Can you imagine that? First thing they did when they hit the ground was Noah took some clean animals and he sacrificed them to the Lord. And it was a pleasing aroma to God. And it says in Genesis 8, if we back up a little bit, as long as the earth endures, God said, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. And then he assured Noah and his family, I will establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. Can you imagine what a relief that must have been to them after just spending a year on the ark? And I think God is sensitive to our emotional needs, and he certainly was in that case. So that's the Noahic covenant. Now what? They're off the ark. Now what? What's next for Noah? And if you think about it, Noah, the whole world was really open to him. He could go wherever he wanted, do whatever he wanted. It wasn't like, you know, when Columbus arrived to the new world of the Americas, you know, when he got here, there were people, you know, people to greet him. And it wasn't like that. It was more like Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. There's no one there. It's completely uninhabited. And so what does this kind of second Adam now do? Interestingly, he goes back to the soil, which I wonder if that was just because he missed it so much. You know, he goes back to the ground, back to the garden, and he tends a vineyard. So let's read, starting in verse 18 from Genesis 9. It says, the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. Just a little reminder there, and that'll be important in a little bit. These were the three sons of Noah, and from them came the people who were scattered over the earth. We'll say more about that in chapter 10. Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard, and when he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. So just as after the first beginning in chapter 1, just as that was quickly followed by sin, the pattern continues in chapter 9 after this new beginning. Just as his father Adam was tripped up by a fruit, so Noah stumbles by a fruit. And please bear with me for a moment, because I want to kind of go off on a little bit of a tangent. Now, when people hear that, sometimes they think, oh, we're going to talk about something completely unrelated. But a tangent is actually, well, if you think about geometry, it's a tangent is like a point of contact. So what I want to talk about does touch our text, okay? It just isn't necessarily the main point. But we have time for this morning, and so I want to go there because I think it's important. We should find in our text this morning a warning for us. The very first mention in the Bible of drunkenness is accompanied by tragedy. And how many millions of times has that pattern been repeated in history? I want to say this very directly. If you drink to the point of excess, drunkenness, the Bible is very clear. You are sinning against God. And you are inviting tragedy. And as a pastor of some 20 or so years, I could give you story after story of how tragedy has followed drunkenness and has resulted in pain and heartache. And oftentimes, this has multi-generational consequences. Children suffer for the sins of their parents and even their grandparents. And so I urge you, do not be deceived. Do not make light of this. Even as we say this, we want to have a balanced and biblical view of alcohol. We are not willing to contradict the Bible. The Bible says that wine itself is a blessing from God and that it may be enjoyed. And so it is wrong, and when I say wrong, I mean sinful. It is sinful to declare off limits for someone else what God has given as a blessing. Okay? And we might make a personal decision to abstain from alcohol, which I did about going on 27 years ago because I had a problem with drunkenness. It was sinful. And so I made a personal decision to abstain from alcohol altogether and have not returned to that. Okay, so we might make a personal decision about alcohol to abstain, but what we are not permitted to do is impose that on other people. Remember the passage from 1 Timothy 4 that we looked at last week? Paul declared that demons are teaching that what God has made for man to enjoy, in that case, meat and marriage specifically, that those things are off limits. And he says that those teachings come from hypocritical liars, but the real source of that is actually demonic. And it almost sounds like an exaggeration to us. Like, well, Paul, you could have made the point without exaggerating. But that's because we don't understand. A demon says God has made a mistake. He should have never given that to you. There's a better way. And this is a demonic teaching. Now, some people will look at this and they'll say, how possibly can wine be a blessing from God? Do we believe the word? Here's what it says in Psalm 104. He waters the mountains from his upper chambers. The earth is satisfied by the fruit of his work. Is water a blessing from God? He makes grass grow for the cattle and plants for man to cultivate, bringing forth food from the earth. Is food a blessing from God? Wine that gladdens the heart of man. Is wine a blessing from God? Oil to make his face shine, bread that sustains his heart. Now, as we've noted many times before, the devil does not seem to have, anyway, from what we know from the Bible, any creative ability. He merely corrupts. He comes to kill, rob, and destroy. Those are all negative things. He doesn't build anything. He takes what's good and he corrupts it over and over. God created sex. Sex is good. Sex outside of marriage is sinful and it comes with consequences. God created food. Food is therefore good. Gluttony, however, is sinful and it comes with consequences. God gave us rest. Rest is good. Laziness is excess and it's not good. It's sinful and it comes with consequences. God gave us wine. Wine is good. But wine to excess is drunkenness, and drunkenness is sinful and it comes with consequences. So if you are wise enough to understand the dangers of alcohol. And there are dangers with alcohol, like there are dangers with food and sex and other things. If you're wise enough to understand the dangers of alcohol, do not let the devil deceive you into taking an extreme and unbiblical position that actually contradicts the Word of God. Don't be so committed to your viewpoint that you would actually call God a liar and join with demonic teachings. And we should also note this. Again, there is no command to drink wine. Okay? Just as there's no command to eat meat. It is not sinful to abstain. So I want to summarize the Bible's teaching on wine. And this would go for meat too, I guess. There are two sins and there are two freedoms. It is sinful to overindulge. God's blessings must be enjoyed on His terms, not on the devil's terms. And it is sinful to call God's blessing evil. And it is sinful to prohibit others from enjoying God's blessings. The devil is going to try to force you into one extreme or the other. Do you know that? He'll always try to do that. He'll either try to get you to be sloppy drunk, passed out in a pile of your own vomit over here. Okay? Or he'll try to get you over here going, well, I don't ever drink and I would never let alcohol touch my lips. And he's going to get you to be more pure than Jesus because you have a stricter set of rules than Jesus. One of those extremes. And honestly, I don't know that it matters that much to him which one you choose. He just doesn't want you in the biblical balanced position on alcohol or on anything else because he's trying to corrupt everything. Does that make sense? So two sins, overindulgence and then calling God's blessing evil. And there are also two freedoms. There's the freedom to enjoy and there is the freedom to abstain. Enough said on that. But before we move on and look at this episode here of Noah and his drunkenness, I want to speak to young people particularly, but maybe to some of us older people and to anyone to whom this would apply. Let me warn you, do not laugh at sin. Do not be entertained by sin. Do not laugh at drunkenness. Young people, your peers are going to laugh. They're going to tell stories about this person who has passed out and they were wasted and they were blitzed and they did this funny thing. And everybody's going to laugh. Ha, ha, ha. It's so funny. Everybody's laughing. Is God laughing? Now, I've done this. I'm sorry to admit. I have found sin to be entertaining. And that itself is sinful. It is wrong to do as Ham did, to make light of wickedness, to find entertainment in what God finds sorrowful. And if you can laugh at wickedness, at drunkenness or something else like that, if you can watch a YouTube video of somebody drunk and passing out and you can laugh and forward that along to someone else, and I'm not thinking of any specific examples here, but if you can do that, that's just a little warning signal. That's just a little thing to see a problem in your own heart, okay? A place to grow. Now let's move on. Verse 20. There are textual reasons here in verse 20 for interpreting this to mean that Noah was the first to plant a vineyard. We translated proceeded to plant a vineyard. It could be translated that he was the first to come up with this idea of planting a vineyard. And so it's argued by some that Noah was actually rather innocent in all of this, that he didn't know what he was doing. He was just drinking and all of a sudden he became drunk. And maybe that's the case. I kind of find that hard to swallow, pun intended. You think about man and how inventive we are when it comes to evil, right? And so we've had all these generations and centuries, and nobody yet has figured out what wine will do and making people drunk. And by the way, the earth was filled with wickedness, it said, and every inclination of man's heart was evil all the time. But nobody thought nobody figured out yet what fermented drink would do. So I think that's a stretch. But in any case, the emphasis here is not on Noah's actions, sinful or otherwise, as much as what would happen next. So Noah is drunk and he's naked on the floor of his tent. Verse 22 says, Ham, the father of Canaan, interesting that it keeps mentioning that, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. They walked in backward and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father's nakedness. Now, there's been a lot of speculation on just what went on here. There must be more to it here. What did Ham really do? Oh, how we like to do that, right? We like to sensationalize everything. Now, without considering all those theories, let's just look at the text again. It explains that Ham saw his father's nakedness, which was wicked, and his brothers intentionally did not. They looked away. They covered him. And these two things are juxtaposed, the wickedness with the righteous deeds. I don't think it was any more complicated than that. Sorry, if you were looking for something sensational, and over the centuries there have been lots of theories, I don't think it's any more complicated than that. One of the sad features of Western society, where we've come, is a widespread disrespect for authority, including parental authority. If only we had eyes to see things the way that God sees them. That should be our prayer. It's no wonder that we go back looking for something more here in this story. Oh, it must be sexual. Because we, as products of our culture, don't tend to fully grasp what a grave offense it is for a son to disrespect his own father. But Moses' original listeners would have understood the gravity here. They weren't asking, oh, well, what was so bad about that? Now, two important things about Hebrew culture, I think, shed light on this. First was the fact that disrespecting one's father was not only sinful, it was really considered one of the very worst things you could do, to disrespect or to disgrace your own father. In fact, that was encoded in the law of Moses later and was one of the things for which someone could actually be stoned. That's how serious of an offense it was in Hebrew culture to do that, to disrespect one's father. And then secondly, it was in Hebrew culture, nakedness was closely associated with shame and humiliation. We think of Jesus on the cross. That was all part of it. Now, combine those, and we see why Ham's actions were regarded by Noah as so very wicked. One more thing that might give us insight into this, too, is that the Hebrew word that is translated saw here, scholars tell us there's really probably a little more going on than that. It probably deserves a stronger word in the English than saw, because it was more like gaze, like he fixed his gaze upon Noah. And so it's more than maybe what meets the eye here. But in any case, Ham should have looked away out of respect. The sin was then compounded by telling his two brothers. We hear about this a lot. We read about it in the book of Proverbs. Guarding what we say, being careful not to become involved in gossip, and how that just leads to more and more sin. And it is presumed that Noah's youngest son, Ham, conveyed this to his brothers with some level of contempt for his father. attempting perhaps to enlist his brothers in the sin of mockery, but they did not join in. Rather, Shem and Japheth honored their father, looked away. Now, kids, I want to say this to young people. I'll bet some of you have encountered a friend at school, or maybe a cousin, or maybe a neighbor that disrespects his parents, makes fun of his parents, openly disobeys and dishonors his or her mom and dad. And when you meet someone like that, you need to understand what the scriptures say about a boy or a girl that does that. It says that they are a fool, and that the scriptures actually say that that person's going nowhere in life. Okay? Now, hopefully they'll repent and change. But you need to understand that. Don't join in. It is not cool if your neighbor makes fun of his own mom or dad. There's nothing cool about that. In fact, I hope maybe a few of you have the boldness to say, hey, you ought not do that. Your mom or dad loves you and they give you a house to live in. You shouldn't be making fun of them or disobeying them. How many of our young people have the boldness to say that to your friends? You think you might get made fun of if you do that? Who thinks you might get made fun of if you say something like that? Well, you know who else was made fun of? Jesus, Paul, some of our heroes. Be bold, okay? Because that's not the world. You need to be different from the world. Don't join in the foolishness and wickedness of a culture that dishonors their parents. Honor your parents as the scriptures command. It will go well for you as the scriptures promise. It did not go well for Ham. And if his brother's reaction did not get his attention, his father's reaction would. Verse 24 says, when Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. Now, so Noah wakes up from his drunkenness. And I imagine the first clue was, how did this garment get here? I'm not even sure if it's his own garment. It may have been just the first thing that Shem and Japheth could find. And he probably did some asking. Well, what's this doing here? Dad, we covered you up. Well, how did you find out I was naked to begin with? What were you doing in my tent? What was going on here? Well, Ham told us, and he was kind of having a good time with it, making sport of you, and we just didn't want him doing that anymore, so we walked in, but we came in backwards, and we just laid that on you. It's kind of how I imagine the conversation going. Noah responds indignantly, and many have wondered here, maybe something's jumping out at you in the text. Why did Noah curse Ham's son and not Ham himself? Poor Canaan, right? You know, why is Grandpa so hard on Canaan? What's the deal here? One suggestion is, if we go back to the beginning of chapter 9, I believe it is, in verse 1, it says that God, right after the flood, blessed Noah and his three sons. And so some say, well, if God had just gotten done blessing Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah can hardly curse his own son now after God blessed him. And so, we'll find out in the genealogy in a little bit that Ham had four sons. And so he takes it out on the youngest son, Canaan, because Ham is his own youngest son. And some people think, well, that's kind of how it worked in Hebrew culture. And that's probably not far off. I don't like that feature of Hebrew culture, I guess, or probably ancient Near East. That's probably how they all were. That could be it. I don't know. Not sure why Noah did that. Another theory is that maybe Canaan was the first to see Noah. drunken. Maybe, you know, it would be like a kid to go in his grandpa's tent, maybe not respecting the privacy as much as a father would. Maybe he came in and said, "Hey, Dad, you got to see Grandpa in here." And so Ham went in and they had a good laugh. Maybe that was it. Maybe that came out. Others speculate that maybe Ham's whole life was just sort of out of control. And that showed up in his sons. And maybe Canaan was the worst one. And maybe what Noah's doing. And sometimes in Scripture, you see this. You'll see it later with Jacob. You can kind of anticipate where someone's life is going. Maybe Noah really just looking at Ham, looking at some things in common that Canaan had with Ham, just sort of saw where all this was going with him. And I might lean toward that explanation. But in the end, we don't know. We do know that we're going to see this played out in history. Canaan would become the father of the Canaanite people, and they would indeed, in time, be subject to the descendants of Shem. They would be slaves of Shem. Verse 26, Noah also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend the territory of Japheth. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his slave." So we get prophecies for all three sons here. So just to break these down, I think we have a slide here. Shem is blessed. I know it says, "Blessed be the Lord of Shem," but that can actually be translated, "Blessed of the Lord is Shem." And I think that kind of makes sense with the context. So Shem is blessed. Ham's line, specifically Canaan, becomes slave of Shem, and it says that twice. Japheth's territory is extended, and then Japheth takes up residence in the tents of Shem. So the first prophecy in verse 26 combines a blessing for Shem and a curse on Ham's son. That one's straightforward, really doesn't need any explanation. The second prophecy in verse 27, a blessing on Japheth, is interesting because the name Japheth actually means enlarge. So Noah's prophecy is kind of a play on words a little bit. It's kind of like saying, "May you become your name. May you be like your name." And Japheth is enlarged as his descendants spread out into what today we would call Europe and Asia Minor. But that very fact of Japheth's enlargement or extension and spreading out makes this third prophecy, the last part of verse 27, kind of mysterious. Shem's descendants, otherwise known as Semites, inhabit a different region altogether than the descendants of Japheth. So how is it that Japheth's descendants are going to live in the tents of Shem? There's really no geographical rejoining of Shem and Japheth that we know of. And I don't think you're going to find anything compelling in the Old Testament to explain that prophecy. So it's kind of mysterious. And just hang on to that because we're going to come back to it later. But let's first move on to chapter 10. Finishing up with chapter 9 here. After the flood, Noah lived 350 years altogether. Noah lived 950 years, and then he died. And so he was 600 when the flood was over. Some people think he was 500 when when he started building the ark, which would mean 99 years, I guess, to build the ark. I'm not sure that we have real good evidence. That's kind of an assumption. But at any rate, verse 10, or chapter 10, verse 1, this is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, who themselves had sons after the flood. And what we're going to get here in this genealogy is not a complete genealogy. We've talked about this in the Bible. It's never, these genealogies are never complete. They're not intended to be. But we're going to get roughly 70 names here, the descendants of the sons of Noah. Why is that significant, that there should be 70 names? Well, 70 is a number that represents fullness in the Bible. And I think this is intentional. We are to have in mind here basically the totality of humanity. So what about these lines? And we won't read all the names here because I probably screw them up really bad. So I've learned that when you're reading these biblical names, you either fake it and act real confident, or you just skip it, and we're going to skip it this morning, so I don't have to fake it. But we'll make some observations here. First, the descendants of Japheth. It's said in verse 5 that some of them were maritime people. It's also translated islands or coastlands. And Derek Kidner, Old Testament scholar, explains that that term represents the distantmost parts of the earth. So we are to picture Japheth's people sort of heading out in boats to the west, and to the north they go. Japheth's descendants were those whom Shem's line would really have the least interaction down through the years, because they were the most geographically separated, at least initially. They spread out to the north and the west, as I mentioned, into what is known today as southern Russia, north of the Black Sea, west across Asia Minor into Europe, possibly as far west as Spain. And we'll look at a couple maps here later. I spent a lot of time this week, just kind of got caught up studying all of this, and got myself really confused. But did find some interesting stuff about just how everything spread out. But Japheth's line kind of just fades out of the Bible from this point on. Until we get the reappearance of them in the New Testament with the rise of Greece. They're also prophesied in Daniel, mentioned in Ezekiel. But you really don't see Japheth back in the Old Testament to speak of, not in the stories and in the narratives. Instead, that's mostly Shem and it's mostly Ham. The Old Testament is going to deal extensively with Ham and his clash with Shem. Those two lines kind of banging together. And Shem is going to be the focus, obviously, because the Messiah comes from that line. With that in mind, on to verse 6. And here we learn of Ham's descendants. And let me say something about the order here. It's common in the book of Genesis for the non-messianic line to get first mention. And so you have Cain coming before Abel. You have Ishmael coming before Isaac. You have Esau coming before Jacob. And here both Japheth and Ham get mentioned before Shem. So the sons of Ham, four of them, you've got Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. And it's interesting that of all Ham's descendants, Nimrod gets by far the most attention. What do we learn of Nimrod here? You just thought that was something you called your friend when you wanted to insult him, right? You Nimrod. Actually, it may be a compliment. I mean, look at this guy. He's a mighty warrior. He's a mighty hunter. So it's, you know, like he hunted people and animals. He became legendary for his hunting skill. He was a king, it appears, because he had a kingdom, says verse 10. And it was a rather wide kingdom, apparently encompassing several regions. And he built great cities. So he was quite accomplished. Now, that expression that he was a mighty hunter before the Lord could just be superlative. In other words, he was such a great hunter that even God took notice of that. We probably shouldn't take that to mean that he was godly himself. Why all this attention on Nimrod? Israel, in the coming centuries, is going to have extended contact and conflict with these ancient and famous Mesopotamian cities. And Moses is giving the background here. Now, some of the other names probably look familiar to you. If you look at verses 15 to 17, it says Canaan was the father of Sidon, his firstborn, and of the Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites, Girgashites, Hivites, on and on. Moses was preparing the Israelites with information about the people that they are going to encounter when they go into the land of promise. Finally, jump down to Shem here. It's interesting that the text starts out in verse 21 by saying that Shem was the ancestor of all the sons of Eber. Why so? Why does it say that? Well, Eber is thought to be the name from which the word Hebrew is derived. If you've ever wondered about that, where did the word Hebrew come from? We think it's from the word Eber. Moses is telling the children of Israel, the Hebrews, who already knew that they were out of Eber, that they are sons of Shem. Peleg, verse 25, is another important name. You'll see that in the New Testament in Jesus' genealogy. As the text indicates, his name means divided, and it could have something to do with channels of water that sort of cut up the land and broke it up and divided into land masses. But I think the more likely explanation here why it mentions this is that it's placing Peleg probably in the time of the Tower of Babel. And that was the time that not that the land masses were divided, but the people were divided. Humanity was divided up and separated according to new languages. And we're going to learn more about that next week in chapter 11. Verse 32, a summary. These are the clans of Noah's sons according to their lines of descent within their nations. From these, the nations spread out over the earth after the flood. And that just kind of sandwiches everything in between with the introduction, what they call an inclusio. Now, I have a slide here, or actually a couple slides, just to show you, kind of go back. And I'm not sure that everything on here is exactly right. There are probably some mistakes there, but I looked for my little laser today. I couldn't find it. Sorry. But if you look there, you can see the Mediterranean Sea. Go to the right a little bit. You'll see Israel, that tiny little area there. I can't even read that in yellow, what that is. But I think it's red there, Elisha. Okay, that is actually a Japhethite tribe. And all those red tribes would be Japhethites. And you see Magog up there in Russia and Tarshish all the way over here in Spain. And that's speculation there. But you see kind of the big picture. The Japheth is going north and west. You've got Ham coming down into Africa, a little bit west and a little bit actually northwest. And then you've got Shem over here in the middle, in the blue. OK, if that makes sense. All right. So back to that. Oh, actually, there's another slide, too. That locates, that's a better map, but that locates some of the names a little better for you, if that makes sense. Back to that prophecy that Japheth will live in the tents of Shem. How do we make sense of that? There are several theories that have been advanced to try to clear up this mystery, what this prophecy is pointing to. Some people, reading ahead into Genesis 14, think that it signals possibly an alliance between Elam, which was a Semitic tribe descended from Shem, and Tidal, the king of Goim, a Japhethite tribe, as they fought against the Hamites. And you can read about that in Genesis 14. That's the story in which you remember when Abram went and rescued his nephew Lot because they had carried him off. And you wonder, how does Abram do that, go up against all these kings? Well, I imagine by the strength of the Lord. But it seems odd to me that such a narrow little thing, that this little alliance here could account for what appears to be sort of a broad sweeping prophecy that Japheth would dwell in the tents of Shem. So I don't know about that one. Here's another idea that's been proposed. The Greeks were clearly Japhethites, if you looked at the map here. And some think that Noah's prophecy could have something to do with Alexander the Great, which was 4th century B.C. Alexander the Great came in and he conquered these Semitic peoples, the Shemites. In that sense, Japheth living in the tents of Shem would be very much uninvited, right? They would be coming in not as welcomed guests into Shem's tents, but as invaders. That seems to be broader, maybe makes a little more sense of all of that. But why would Noah wish such a thing on Shem, right? It seems like this prophecy that Noah is making about Shem is a blessing. And so why would he say, and here's part of the blessing, Alexander the Great's going to come in and take everything you have. So I'm not sure about that one. There are other theories we won't bother to go into that I don't know make a lot of sense to me. But in any case, there seems to be some kind of partnership going on between Shem and Japheth. And so another theory deserves mention. And by the way, before we talked about this concept of census plenior, I don't know if you remember that. That's a Latin phrase for the fuller sense. And we take that, we ascribe that, or we apply that to prophecies oftentimes in the Old Testament. The census plenior is just the idea that a lot of times you find a prophecy in the Old Testament that has an immediate fulfillment, but then it has a fuller fulfillment later. And a lot of the messianic prophecies are that way. So David in Psalm 22 says, you know, they're counting my bones, that these enemies are surrounding me, they're mocking me, they're saying he trusts in the Lord, let the Lord rescue him. And we look back on that and we read Matthew 27 and we say, wow, that looks a lot like what's happening on the cross, like amazingly similar. Well, David was applying it to himself, probably had no idea that this fuller sense would come along centuries later. And I think that's probably what's going on here. I think Noah, there's probably something happening closer to Noah's time in which Shem and Japheth are coming together, okay? Even though we don't see anything like that. But I also suspect that there's a fuller sense. The Gospel of Luke traces the Jewish Messiah's genealogy back to Noah's son Shem. It's very clear Jesus was a Semite, okay, or a Shemite, if you will. You've heard the term Semitism and anti-Semitism, right? That's to remind us that the Israelite people descended from Shem. But did Jesus come only to save the Shemites? Paul, writing to Japhethites in Asia Minor, stated this in Ephesians chapter 3. He says, in reading this, then, you will be able to understand my insight into the mystery of Christ, which was not made known to men in other generations, as it has now been revealed by the Spirit to God's holy apostles and prophets. This mystery is that through the gospel, the Gentiles, you guys, in other words, are heirs together with Israel, members together of one body, and sharers together in the promise of Christ Jesus. Shemites, Japhethites, members together, sharers together. There is a partnership between Shem and Japheth. The gospel, through the preaching of Paul, went north and west into Japhethite lands. There, Japheth received the gospel and took up spiritual residence in the tents of Shem, you might say, embracing the gospel of Christ. And in the fullest sense of the word live, Japheth lives in the tents of Shem. And some would disagree and say, That I don't think that's what's going on there, but I think there's something to that. Now, not everyone here this morning is a Japhethite, okay? But most of us are. So, may we be thankful for Shem. May we be thankful for our Semite brothers. May we embrace them and find unity with them. May we rejoice in the gospel that is found everywhere, even in the shadows of Genesis 9, we who are from Japheth. God isn't just saving Japhethites. God isn't just saving Noah in an ark. God is saving all men from every tribe and language and people and nation, it says in Revelation. Shemites, Japhethites, Hamites, doesn't matter what you are, Jesus is saving us all. And for that, we praise him.